Good morning, honorable members.
Good morning.
And the team from the Reserve Bank, Banking Supervision. It's a division within, if I'm right.
Good.
Yeah. Thanks, Errol, for coming and your team. You'll introduce your people as we move on. We have the Standing Committee on Finance here with two apologies, SWAPT and MSWAPT. Will be joined by others as we move on, but we think we should start. The purpose of our meeting is part of an ongoing briefing process that we have started, particularly within the financial sector generally, including the banking sector, to acquaint ourselves with the work and functionalities of related institutions that do work under National Treasury. It is our first time that we'll be interacting with yourselves, and therefore, for us, it is more of an information sharing session through your annual reports that you're going to present to us. And the second item of the day is going to be your direct responsibility on international financial market crisis in terms of your interpretation, your analysis, and so on and so forth. And we'll take it from there. Honestly, we think it is a very, very important presentation that we are receiving today. We have had interactions with others, and as we receive one presentation after the other, it leads us to other institutions that we say it is important to interact with these people also. You're welcome. I don't know if I've done this kind of work before. I'm new. The committee is a new committee. If you have done it before, take it as if you're doing it for the first time to us. Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you, Chair, for those introductory comments. Good day to the honourable members. From our side, on my right-hand side, I have Yvette Singh, who is the Deputy Registrar of Banks in the Bank Supervision Department at the South African Reserve Bank. And on my left-hand side is Johan Nietling, who is a manager in my office, also in the Bank Supervision Department of the Reserve Bank. As you have already mentioned, Chair, that there will be two presentations from our side today, the first one being on our annual report for the calendar year ended December 2009. In terms of the Banks Act, we are required to do a report on a calendar year basis. And then the second one that we will do this morning is, as you have mentioned, the one on some interpretations and remedial actions in terms of the financial crisis which the world has seen. So if I could start with the first presentation. The agenda that we will be going through on the first presentation is really set out. the introduction, what the status of the sector was during 2009, what the regulatory developments have been during the period under review, and then the four chapters of the annual report, the so-called Registrar of Banks review, chapter two, the overview of our activities in the issue of achieving our overall actual mission of promoting the soundness of the banking system, some issues relating to the banking legislation which happened during the course of the year, and then in chapter four is the quantitative side of the report, which is the trends in the banking sector. What we have done for that part of this presentation is we are not presenting the trends as at December 2009 because we felt that would be a little bit outdated by now, but we've rather updated that to June this year so that you can get a better view, that the honourable members can see what is the actual current position of the banking sector, and then just to say what the appendices are. So in introduction, as I have said, that the department executes its functions in terms of the Banks Act 1990, as amended from time to time, and the mission of our department is to promote the soundness of the banking system through the effective and efficient application of international regulatory and supervisory standards. I think it is important to note that it is the system that we are looking at. We might take decisions on individual banks, which might not be always very palatable to individual banks, but we do look at our decisions being in the interest of the system as a whole. And then obviously looking at what is best practice around the globe and to apply that with local conditions having been taken into account. The philosophy of our department, firstly, that market principles underlie all our activities and decisions that we take. I think we say that that we exist as a department not only because of the legislation which enacts our activities, but also because there is a market out there and we need to take cognizance that that we facilitate that market. Clearly, we need to act with professionalism, integrity, credibility and impartiality at all times. I think that is highly, highly non-negotiable in our terms of reference and in our mandate, that we are impartial in the way we discharge our duties and our responsibilities in the interests of the banking sector. In our department, we have what we call a single point of entry for the banks. In other words, those banks that we supervise have one person that they come into the department in terms of communication via what we call a relationship manager, who is assisted by a team who has diverse competencies. And the single point of entry is quite important to ensure that we do not have arbitrage taking place and that we understand exactly at all times what is approaching us. We have a risk-based approach to our supervision. Our objective is to add value. And by a risk-based approach, really twofold. One is that we do concentrate on the risks that the banking sector faces, and secondly, to apply our resources in a way that our time and effort goes into those areas which we have ascertained and that we have regarded as the highest risk areas. We have an emphasis on empowering our staff, ensuring that we offer a professional service to the industry that we supervise, and obviously, as we have said, the ethical behavior, which is very important, and then that there is mutual trust between ourselves and the key stakeholders that we interact with, and as we always would say to the people that we are involved with, regular open communication is very important, that there are no expectation gaps, and that we are very clear in what we're doing and that people understand what we're doing and why we are doing it. If we look at the framework within which we apply the philosophy that I have just outlined, we had what we called a revised supervisory framework, which was implemented on the 1st of January 2008, And that was as a result of substantial amendments to the framework, which incorporated the so-called Basel II framework. And Basel II really meant that there was a more risk-based approach to the methodology for calculating the capital requirements that banks need to comply with. And around all of that is really the issue of how the risks are managed, how they are monitored, how they are disclosed, and that there is sufficient capital to act as buffers for banking systems in times of need. Within that framework, we have what's known as the supervisory review and evaluation process, which is really the risk-based supervision approach that we have. We have a matrix structure where we have specialists as well as line managers who work with the banks, diverse competencies, and then essentially those teams work within a legal framework which consists of the primary legislation being the Banks Act, Act No. 94 of 1990. In terms of the Banks Act, regulations relating to banks are issued. That's for the day-to-day reporting of statutory returns, etc., to ourselves. And then also on a more micro level, the issuance of directives, Banks Act circulars, and guidance notes to the various parties and the banks to enable them to continue on a day-to-day basis with their activities. A little bit of a busy slide, but just to give you some of the detail of what the supervisory review and evaluation process involves. And if the honourable members could just look at it from the middle outwards. So if we start with the SREP cycle right in the middle, as we've said, the issues that are in the red block CP is a continuous process, and this is really a cycle that we go through. Firstly, developing a supervisory plan. Key areas are identified, the risks are identified. Once that has been done, the second step being gathering of information, quantitative and qualitative type of information, then forming a view and prioritizing the risk areas, which feeds into a supervisory plan. We do have a supervisory plan. Each analyst that works in our department has a supervisory plan for the banks for which they are responsible for supervising. There would be focused reviews which would then take place either on site or off-site desktop type analyses. We would have a review panel in the department which would then review the conclusions of the reviews that have been undertaken. And then quite importantly, the sixth step is to then feed this back to the senior management and the board of directors of the bank concerned so that they are fully aware of what our views are of the situation within the banks, and also to discuss any remedial plans which might be necessary for senior management and board members to undertake and to work out a plan of action as to how that would take place, how that would feed back into ourselves until the remedies have been fully implemented, and then the cycle starts again. So as I was saying, these cycles work in a 12-monthly cycle. One or two instances we have a bit of a longer cycle, sometimes maybe 18 months if the risks are slightly less, but I would say on average about a 12-month cycle for each of the institutions that fall under our supervision and guidance. Just looking at the organizational structure of the department, looking at the first block, which is myself as the head of it, the Registrar of Banks, and I'm assisted by three deputy registrars. The first one on the left-hand side is Yvette Singh, who is with us today. The second one is Mr. Madoda Petros, and the third one, Advocate Michael Blackbeard. And as each one of those deputy registrars have a specific area, we have them listed for which they are responsible. So essentially the two deputy registrars, Yvette Singh and Madoda Petros, are responsible for the day-to-day supervision of the banking sector, whereas Advocate Michael Blackbeard, as we can see, is responsible for the regulatory side, the legal services, and the implementation of actual policies. So in essence, one can say the two on the left is for the day-to-day supervision, and the one on the right is the legal division within our department. In total, underneath the structure, there are about 110 people which slot into those various areas. Our support people would probably be about 25 to 30 people if we have to take the IT people that we have, our correspondence people, etc., and all the support functions, with obviously the majority of our people being those that are responsible for the supervision of the banking institutions. As I had mentioned a bit earlier, the annual report is for the year ended 31 December 2009 and issued in terms of Section 10 of the Banks Act, and it does present an overview of the objectives and activities of the department for the calendar year 2009. With that as introduction, if I could move on to the second area, being the status of the financial sector stroke banking sector during 2009. As has been set out in the report, one can see that the banking sector continued to experience, as we termed it, a challenging operating environment during 2009 due to a few specific issues. One, the cyclical downturn in domestic economic conditions. Secondly, the aftermath of the so-called international financial market crisis. Thirdly, consumer spending did remain subdued during the period as a result of the downturn in the economic conditions. And as a result of those, the level of impaired advances in the asset portfolios of the banks continued to increase during 2009. Impaired advances means those loans and advances which have been made to customers, which have in essence progressed to a bad debt category, and obviously the asset portfolios of banks would then consist in the main of home loans, personal loans, credit cards, and the like. I think the important thing to say, however, is that notwithstanding these difficult circumstances, our banking system did remain stable during the period under review, as it had the previous year as well. It remained profitable, and unlike in a number of the international counterparts in the global economy, capital levels in our banks were adequate throughout the period. I would also like to mention for the honourable members here that the international financial market crisis, which we will talk about in a bit more detail later, but I think it's just important to mention that on a global basis, it was really the banking systems which was the catalyst for the crisis that occurred, whereas in South Africa, it was really the opposite way around, in the sense that our banking system remained sound, and the downturn in the economic conditions was as a result of the secondary effects of the interconnectivity that the economy has with the global markets, and hence together with the cyclical downturn in our economy, these are the issues which then did arise. But I think, as I have said, the banking system did remain stable and profitable, capital levels were fine. The central bank in South Africa did not have to in any way assist any bank during this period under review, unlike in quite a number of the international countries, and nor did the government have to provide any finance or funding for any of the banks in our banking system. So I think just as a snapshot, that being the status of the sector during 2009. If we could then look at some of the international regulatory developments which took place during the year under review. In response to what we had seen in terms of the financial crisis, various standard-setting bodies, I think notably the Financial Stability Board, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision as well, both of these bodies continued their respective processes of developing and issuing guidance and standards to strengthen the resilience of the financial sector in general, and more specifically the banking sector. I think we are aware of the work of the G20, the finance ministers, heads of state involved in the G20 initiatives, and the Financial Stability Board, which takes their mandate from the G20 for the broader financial sector, and then the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, which is situated in the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, taking the initiative for the banking sector, and it is in that particular area where we reside in terms of the banking sector. So just a few of the key issues which came out during the period under review from the Basel Committee in response to enhancing the supervisory framework under which banks would need to operate. In July, there was an enhancement to the framework, which in essence was around the issues surrounding market risk and guidelines for computing capital for incremental risk in the trading book. So really market risk and the trading book environment. And what we mean by market risk being those types of instruments which are susceptible to movements in price on a daily basis, and trading book is obviously in respect of those instruments which are traded on a daily basis. Those two items were not that heavily impacted on in terms of South Africa, in the sense that our trading book activities were not as voluminous as what one saw in the international framework, and our market risk was quite a smaller proportion of total activities as when compared to international counterparts. Then on the 7th of September, there was a comprehensive response to the global banking crisis post the G20 Pittsburgh summit, which again fleshed out some of the issues on liquidity as well as on the market risk and trading book side. And then on the 17th of December, the back end of last year, a comprehensive consultative proposal was released by the Basel Committee, in essence to increase and strengthen the resilience of banking sectors and also introducing minimum liquidity ratios. Just to go into a little more detail on what those developments were in terms of those announcements, during December 2009. Firstly, to raise the quality, consistency and transparency of Tier 1 capital of banks. Just to mention for the honourable members that capital of banks is divided into two categories: Tier 1 capital, which is the primary capital, and Tier 2 capital, which is secondary capital. And obviously Tier 1 is a much more sustainable form of capital. Secondly, to introduce a series of measures to promote the build-up of capital buffers during good times, i.e. to introduce a counter-cyclical capital framework, so during the good times to build capital which can absorb losses during downturns in cyclical economic cycles. Thirdly, to strengthen the risk coverage of the capital framework, to actually broaden that, to have capital requirements for counterparty credit risk arising from derivatives, which as one saw was part of the problem during the crisis. Introducing a leverage ratio for banks, and a leverage ratio really means how many times has one used one's capital to borrow money, and that was probably one of the most important issues which contributed to the global crisis, these very high leverage ratios or leverage multiples. And then finally, to introduce a minimum liquidity standard for internationally active banks, so a liquidity coverage ratio and a longer term structural liquidity ratio. And really in terms of a coverage ratio, to look at how the liabilities are covered by the assets and then structurally on a longer term to ensure that there's not an overly negative mismatch on books. Obviously, we do monitor and closely consider these developments as they are applicable to ourselves, and would incorporate those on our domestic banking sector to strive for the application of achieving the mission statement. Just a snapshot of these items and what the status is of those in relation to bank supervision in South Africa. Raising the quality and consistency of Tier 1 capital, that would be something which falls within the parameters that we already have or can easily attain. Counter-cyclical capital buffers, that is something which we can surely implement. Capital surcharges to mitigate the risk of systemic banks. We do have the ability to add those capital surcharges in terms of our legislation, should we wish to do that. Strengthening the framework in the area of securitization and trading book positions, that has already been done by us. The leverage ratio, introducing that as a supplementary measure to the risk-based framework already in place, that is fine for us. I think the one which would be an issue in South Africa is the liquidity standards which will be issued. I think South Africa has, as a structure in the financial sector, a more shorter term based liquidity structure, and obviously we would need some time to for banks to try and adjust to a more rigid liquidity regime. So I think that covers the international regulatory developments which have taken place. I think it's quite apparent from this that there is a lot of detailed work behind all of this, but in essence I think it's on the capital side, being counter-cyclical, looking at systemic banks, and then looking at the liquidity side to ensure that there is sufficient liquidity in the system. If we could move on to the review for the year, a few items which were of importance during our work for the year under review. The first one, if I could refer the honourable members to the Article 4 consultation, which was undertaken by the International Monetary Fund. It's a report which was completed on the 20th of July last year, and it's something which the IMF and the World Bank jointly conduct fairly regularly on countries around the world. The report broadly described the South African financial sector as remaining vigilant and indicated the banking system remained liquid and well capitalized. Key findings of the report was that credit risk, i.e. the issue of impaired advances as and when they arise, was mitigated by supportive macroeconomic policies, stringent bank loan origination standards, and a decline in the demand for extensive credit. The reliance on short-term wholesale corporate deposit funding was highlighted as the structural issue in the South African sector, as I have just alluded to. The dominance of the financial system by a few large financial conglomerates with cross-border shareholdings, cross-sector activities. Second last, the probabilities of default had increased, and I think that was quite a logical conclusion given the cycle that one was going through, but were significantly lower than those of several large international banks in mature economies, and that it's also found that the supervision of banks in South Africa had generally been intensified since 2008 in response to the financial sector risks which had emanated coming from the global crisis. The second area was the compliance with anti-money laundering and the combating of the financing of terrorism standards. During 2009, the Financial Action Task Force, the FATF, who is headquartered in Paris, published their final report on the evaluation of South Africa's AML-CFT measures as it was at that point in time. The key findings of the report which are important to note to the honourable members that this is not only a report on the banking system, but on anti-money laundering as a whole across the entire country and all participants and players, ranging from attorneys boards, gambling boards, insurance, banking, estate agents and the like. The findings that were concluded by the FATF was that the criminalisation of the financing of terrorism were comprehensive in the legislation. The Financial Intelligence Centre was operating effectively. The scheme for confiscating the proceeds of crime was comprehensive. The Financial Intelligence Centre Act imposed customer due diligence record keeping, so that's what banks would need to do very typically in ensuring that they have the know your customer requirements in place for all their clients. The suspicious transaction reporting, so where banks would need to report if should they believe that a client is conducting some suspicious form of monetary activity, those controls are in place. That the Financial Intelligence Centre Act covers the majority of financial institutions and non-financial businesses and professions. That the cooperation among South African authorities on operational matters to combat money laundering are effective. And that we do, so that South Africa as a whole does provide mutual legal assistance, including the possibility of extradition with other countries. The third item, which we wanted to...
Sir, Errol?
Yes, sir.
We appreciate that you are going to elaborate a presentation prepared. I'm just looking at the number of slides you have. And the fact that you still have got another presentation to make, whether in each slide you just don't want to, probably it would be better just to highlight key areas into that rather than to read point, bullet point by bullet point. This is very valuable information for members later on to can refer on their own. But let's just say, deal with the heart of a particular slide.
Okay.
Otherwise, one honorable member just indicated to me what about how many slides? 46 slides. 64 slides. And if we had to go bullet by bullet, bullet point by bullet point, it will take us much longer. So let's just deal with the key thrust of the slide. I know it might complicate your life, but this is a subject that we've been dealing with. You know very well. This, what I see before me, is a simplified version of something that you could have done in a better way on your side if you were to do it for yourself. But for honorable members, you have to do it this way, to elaborately look into each and every fact. So let's just try to see the best way of dealing with it. I think honorable members, I'm in order.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. The next issue which we wanted to highlight was our involvement in the regional issues within the African region. The Financial Stability Institute, which is a division within the Bank for International Settlement in Switzerland, hosts a high-level meeting on an annual basis together with ourselves in South Africa, where a number of the heads of supervisory authorities from the African region do attend, and a number of topics are covered during that meeting in order to ensure that as a region we are also up to date with exactly what is going on in the key principles and the key developments which are coming out of the Basel Committee. And it's about a 3-day seminar which the African region attends, and we have listed the topics which are or which were covered at that particular session during January of 2009, and that is set out for the honourable members on that particular slide. The next area that we looked at during the course of the year under review was the incentive schemes of banking institutions. I think important to note here that prior to incentive schemes having become a so-called flavor of the year topic, which came out of the international standard setting bodies, already during 2008, South Africa did do a review of all our banks and their incentive schemes and how that how they stacked up. The actual principles that we found, which were embedded in those schemes, is outlined there, that it is in line with the objectives of the organization. Risk management does form a process in that assessment, and that also the standards which then came out during 2009 from the Financial Stability Board itself, and which should be implemented by banking institutions and reinforce the supervisory processes at the national level, were very much in line with what they had already done during 2008. So I think to say that we had already commenced with this work in 2008, followed through in 2009, and then this is forming part of our focus for 2010. So incentive schemes, certainly something which was on our radar screen ahead of it becoming a flavor of the year topic. The responses by the standard setting bodies which came out during the year, I have referred to that earlier on in the scene set which we gave up front, but just for the honourable members again to get a view of what those issues were and just to reinforce them, and those are set out at the bottom of the slide what the key aims of the broader program are in terms of the standards which are going to be introduced in response to the financial crisis by the international and global standard setting bodies. And again, we come back to capital, liquidity, and a forward-looking approach to the provisioning areas. I did refer earlier to the Pittsburgh summit, which informed the release by the Basel Committee of their standards, and these are the issues which came out of the Pittsburgh summit, which have fed into those, and I've just highlighted them there in terms of capital. The prudential oversight of in terms of improving risk management, enhancing the scope of regulation of over-the-counter derivatives, securitization markets, as well as looking at the implementation of stress tests within organizations, and then striking an adequate balance between macroprudential and microprudential regulation to control risk. In response to that, the Basel Committee did issue its comprehensive package in 2009, in December 2009, and I think it's expected that in response to that, a fully calibrated set of standards will be developed by the end of this year to be phased in as financial conditions improve and the economic recovery start looking a bit better, with a view to implementation January 2013. So I think important to just highlight for the honourable members that all of these proposals which have been put forward are in the process of being field tested at the moment. So there is no finality on it as yet, but they are being field tested across all countries to see what the impact would be and to assess the impact of that implementation, and then to finalise the standards, and then to give countries 2 years to prepare for the implementation of that. Just to highlight that we are represented on a number of these task groups and working committees, and do contribute to the forums which are involved in the design of these proposals. Starting off with SADC, we are a member of the SADC subcommittee of banking supervision, which is a subcommittee of the Central Bank Governors Committee in SADC, and then a number of other subcommittees of the Basel Committee, which are listed in the remaining bullets on that slide, where members of our staff do participate and give their views and do influence the debates in those particular areas. Very important for us is our skill development, that we have our people properly equipped to discharge their duties and ensuring that we discharge our responsibilities in terms of the Banks Act. We spent just under R1 million on training of approximately 107 of our employees during the year under review. A number of training interventions were arranged, which are quite wide-ranging, from technical as well as to managerial courses, risk management and supervisory workshop. And as I said, the main purpose of the training is to ensure that we have staff who are properly equipped with the necessary tools and techniques to ensure that they can meet the supervisory tasks in ensuring that we discharge our duties and responsibilities in a responsible manner. Regional cooperation, which we had during the year under review, we have just highlighted on this slide a number of the issues during the year that we were involved in terms of the various countries in the region. And we have just highlighted four of the interventions that we were involved in up in Namibia, Tanzania, Zambia, as well as in Kenya. And as one can see there, quite a lot of work has been done in those areas and a lot of interaction to ensure regional harmonization between South Africa and the banking supervisory authorities in those particular jurisdictions. And then lastly for Chapter 1, just to highlight those particular issues which we would be focusing on during the course of this year. Quite obviously we need to be focusing on what legislative and regulatory changes would be required for the framework in South Africa. We would be looking at our supervisory review and evaluation process to make sure that that is properly honed for the new requirements. Our continued participation in various international forums, implementation of stress testing scenarios and methodologies at the respective banks, backtesting of credit risk models, ensuring that those particular models are properly calibrated for the calculation of the capital requirements, continued work on anti-money laundering and the countering and financing of terrorism legislation, as well as the continued investigation of those illegal deposit-taking cases which are referred to us where unregistered people and or institutions are accepting deposits in contravention of the Banks Act. So, honourable members, that's really Chapter 1, as I said, which is the review for 2009, the items that were on our agenda. If we could move on to Chapter 2, which is really the chapter which spells out how the promotion of the soundness of the banking system was maintained during the year under review and the activities that we undertook. The first area was credit risk, the second area was market risk, and then operational risk and capital adequacy assessments. Those are the sort of key areas and transparency which we looked at to ensure that the banking system as a whole does remain sound. And in terms of credit risk, one always is aware of the fact that credit risk is probably one of the biggest risks that face the banking system in terms of impairments which could arise. So quite a number of items were conducted in terms of work relating to credit risk as to how the capital positions of banks would stack up in terms of the downturn in the economy, how banks are compliant. IRB refers to the internal ratings-based approach, and that is how banks would be assessing their risk in terms of which they would then calculate the capital that they need to maintain for the risk in terms of credit risk exposures that they have. And then also there's a standardized approach, and one undertook a number of reviews there, and then also the actual processing of applications for new models by banks that would want to enhance their capital calculation methodologies in terms of credit risk. The second area that we looked at to promote the soundness was looking at market risk, where a number of reviews were undertaken of the models being used by banks full regulatory reporting, as well as we looked at a comprehensive liquidity risk management profile for each of the banks, which we undertook with each of the boards of the bank of the banks during 2009, as well as asset and liability management processes, which was a review, a thematic review, which was undertaken at a number of the banks to ensure that there was proper asset and liability management, particularly under stress circumstances. And then just finally to say that no new applications for any internal modeled approaches were received during 2009. Operational risk. A number of reviews were undertaken in terms of operational risk to ensure that managements of banks have proper dashboards at their disposal and it is being properly used to identify operational risk events which might take place in their organizations. Detailed reviews of scenario approvals, governance processes, and the scenarios which were used by banks in their application of their models to actually calculate capital in respect of operational risk to which they are exposed. And then also a participation in an international operation, an operational loss data collection exercise was performed where South African banks participated in this and was able to receive comparatives as to how they stack up with their international counterparts, and they stacked up extremely well in that basis. The so-called ICAP process, the Internal Capital Adequacy Assessment process, really what is being illustrated here is that what we need to do in terms of our regulations is we need to assess the manner in which banks are calculating their risks and are then calculating the capital that they require in respect of those risks, and that is the process that we would follow. And there were a number of thematic reviews which were conducted at the banks during the year in respect of the calculation of required capital. Pillar 3, Basel 2 has three pillars to it, Pillar 1, Pillar 2, and Pillar 3. And Pillar 3 is the transparency and disclosure pillar. And really what that refers to is what type of information is being disclosed by banks to the markets in terms of as wide-ranging from financial statements through to their monthly publication on their websites of detailed information. And really it was that particular item which was focused on in terms of Pillar 3 during the year, where banks were assessed in terms of their disclosure, and if they were not disclosing properly, it was brought to their attention and remedial action was put in, with the benchmarking process to be a focus area before 2010. Stress testing. Just to say that the stress testing concept is something which has become quite well utilized from an international perspective. We have adopted that into South Africa, and we have had a first focus on stress testing frameworks of banks during the course of the year, and formed a view on a number of the stress tests after a review was conducted with a number of the banks to ensure that they are stressing the scenarios sufficiently so as to ensure that under stress scenarios they would have sufficient liquidity and sufficient capital. And I think that's something which was comprehensively undertaken. The last item in terms of promoting the soundness of our banks during the year was the development in consolidated supervision. Quite a bit of proactive action was taken during the year to look at the consolidated supervision of banking groups. We instituted more regular supervisory meetings between ourselves and the Financial Services Board in terms of the memorandum of understanding which we have with the FSB to ensure that there is a forward-looking approach to the risks that are arising from various conglomerate group, so very typically one would have a bank and or an insurer in a common group. So a lot of work was done on that. Secondly, a policy decision was taken to only allow the acquisition or establishment of cross-border banking operations where a memorandum of understanding with the cross-border banking supervisor had been concluded or can be concluded. I think that was something which came out of the financial crisis quite clearly, was that there was not always enough communication on a consolidated basis between home supervisors and host supervisors, and that we do then plan to hold a what is termed a supervisory college with the African supervisors in these countries. Our South African banking groups have a presence, and then we also recommended to one of the large banks to undergo a restructure so as to make the group less complex and less opaque and for better and more effective supervision. So those are the issues in terms of consolidated supervision. If I could move on for the honourable members to chapter 3 of the report, which was really the developments relating to banking legislation during the year 2009. A number of items were clearly monitored during the year, and will be forming part of quite an extensive process of amending legislation as and where required. We have just listed the particular items which inform what proposals might be needed: the New Companies Act, Board of Review findings, Kingsley, etc. So those are the ones which will inform us what we would want to do. The other area in terms of the legislation, illegal deposit taking, the particular items there have been set out as to the schemes which arose during the year, those which were finalised during the year. But in essence, if one looks at the light blue and one adds the brown and subtracts the green, gets to the dark blue, those are the schemes which are still under investigation, and one can see how many had been investigated and finalised during the year under review. Unfortunately, this is something which remains with us as people on an illegal basis accept deposits as part of their activities, and that gets reported to us for further investigation. The next area was the developments relating to the cooperative banking legislation, which was approved and implemented during 2008, and then the regulatory environment for financial cooperative institutions was something which was established during 2009, with part of the agency being part of the National Treasury and the larger ones being part of a department within the Reserve Bank. This does not fall under the auspices of the Banks Act. It's got its own separate act, but we just put it here for the honourable members to take note that this has been a development during the year, but as I said, not something which we would be supervising in terms of the Banks Act. Similarly, developments regarding the Post Bank, which up until now has operated under an exclusion from the Banks Act, and that is now going to be more formalised, and I think there is some legislation which is very close to implementation at this stage, where the Post Bank would operate as a savings bank once it complies fully with all the requirements, all the governance requirements, and it would be up and running, I do believe, in a reasonably short to medium term. Then the last area which we reported on, which occurred during 2009, was that coming back or going back 2 years where we had an application by a particular party to establish a bank, and the party did not satisfy the requirements for a bank, and this decision of ourselves not to accord the relevant registration a bank registration as a bank was taken on review to the Board of Review, which is established in terms of the Banks Act, and the presiding chair of the board ruled in favour of the decision of the registrar. The applicant then brought an application to the High Court for a review of both the registrar's decision and the Board of Review's decision, and during October of 2009 the High Court confirmed the decision of both the registrar and of the Board of Review, which we feel was quite an important event because it did then set a precedent, a legal precedent for the interpretation of the Banks Act insofar as compliance with the Act is concerned. If I could move on to trends in the South African banking sector, and for the honourable members, as I mentioned earlier, whilst the annual report does refer to trends as at the end of December, those have been updated to June this year, just so that the honourable members can get a more updated view of what is the state of the banking sector as at present. The first slide, really just to point out that the year-on-year asset growth improved during the second quarter of 2010, but has still remained negative year-on-year basis. So if one looks at the year-on-year growth, one can see negative 0.35 if we round that off to 0.4, but one can see where it was in December 2009, negative 6.6, which has improved to a negative 0.35, so that is certainly improving quite substantially. The second area that I would like to highlight is the on the profitability side, really to say that profitability ratios still remain compressed as reflected in the return on equity and the return on asset ratios, as well as a deterioration in the cost-to-income ratio of the banks. And one can see this in this block here, where the cost-to-income ratio has worsened from 49% to 53%, and then the return on equity and the return on assets year-on-year, 17.5% down to 15%, and 0.99% down to 0.97%. Capital adequacy ratios have improved, as I have alluded to earlier during this presentation. One can see the capital adequacy ratios have improved. And then credit risk, I think, which is the important one, is that the ratio of impaired advances as a percentage of the gross loans and advances is certainly not really showing much signs of improvement. Very slight improvement, I think, if one looks at, one can see that the impaired advances as an absolute number has gone from 124 billion to 134 to 136, and the ratio really hovering around the 5.9 levels, which does indicate a fairly high level of impairment in the system, which will take time to work through. Just a very brief slide just to show the distribution of the banking sector assets between the five largest banks and really what the year-on-year growth has been. We see negative 0.35, and one can see how the banks stack up and what their respective contributions are. If we look at the balance sheet, all one really wanted to show on the balance sheet, the growth in total assets, which is this green line, over a two-year period, one can see how, as an effect of the downturn in the global economy, as well as the cyclical cycle in South Africa, how the growth in the assets and the growth in the loans and advances has certainly come down. So in total assets, negative 0.4, which I highlighted earlier, in loans and advances, quite a low 2.3%. So certainly, I think it is encouraging to see that over the last 2 months, these lines have started turning more positive, but if one looks where they came from, it's still quite a way to go. The composition of the total assets of the industry, just to give the honourable members a snapshot to show that about 75% of the total assets of the industry are in respect of loans and advances, which I think shows that that is the main activity of the banks. And then of those loans and advances, one can see what the various categories are in terms of home loans, term loans, leasing and installments, etc., but certainly one can see in terms of home loans and term loans, that makes up almost half of what the total loans and advances book of 2.3 trillion rand is. The composition of liabilities of the banking sector, just to note here that this excludes the equity, so this is only the liabilities, excluding capital, about 2.8 trillion. And one sees that about 87.5% of that is in respect of deposits, which I think indicates a fairly vanilla composition of the deposit book. And if one breaks the deposits down further into the various categories of fixed and notice, call deposits, etc., I think one gets a fairly good snapshot of what the composition of those deposits are. And who are the deposits from? One can see that in this particular slide, the green bar, as at the end of June, shows that about 42% of the total deposits of 2.5 billion come from corporate customers. And I think this reflects, or is a reason for reflecting, the liquidity mismatches, which I had mentioned earlier, that the actual retail funding which banks receive is a bit less than what one would ideally like it. But obviously the savings mechanism in South Africa, a lot of savings goes into insurance companies who then place the deposits back with banks as a corporate deposit. So behind that number is still quite a lot of retail funding in terms of insurance companies. Profitability, really just to again show that profitability ratios do remain compressed. As we saw earlier, and one can see the ROE and the ROA over time, how that has really moved down a bit. We don't have to spend too much time on that. And the cost to income ratio, the higher this ratio, the more under pressure it is becoming, and one can see it's gone up from just over 49% to just over 53% over the last 12 months. Obviously, as profitability has been declining, that ratio has been worsening a bit. On capital adequacy, one can see an improving trend in terms of total equity. Certainly over the last 2 years, banks have been very consciously trying to improve their capital positions, which has been very heartening to ensure that they are properly capitalized to absorb any future losses that could occur. And one sees the split between capital, which is share capital, just under 90 billion, and retained earnings just over 90 billion, which shows a high quality of capital in the system. And one can see that preference shares, etc., form a very, very small part. So I think it's very heartening to see the actual quality of the capital which our banking system has. The financial leverage multiple, as I mentioned earlier, this is how many times one has borrowed against one's capital from the system. And one sees in South Africa that's, as at the end of June, about 15.5 times, down from 18.5 times 2 years ago, compares very, very favorably. At the height of the crisis, one saw that a lot of the international banking groups had those ratios anything between 30 and 60 times. And obviously, as the crisis hit, they were unable to service those the resultant liquidity from that leveraging, and that caused a liquidity crisis. But certainly, our banks are not over-leveraged and in an improving situation. The actual capital adequacy ratio, and the capital adequacy ratio means if one takes the balance sheet in terms of assets, in terms of market risk exposure, and in terms of operational risk exposure, and against those exposures, one must hold a certain amount of capital. And the capital as a percentage of the requirement is the ratio. And one can see that that ratio has been improving over the last 2 years. In terms of the Tier 1 capital adequacy ratio, which is the hardcore capital, that's gone from 9.7% up to 11.2%. And then the total capital from 12.7 up to 14.3. So that is a very healthy situation that we are quite comfortable with. And then just to see what is the composition of that capital, as I've mentioned earlier, a large portion of that being in primary capital, which is on the yellow line, one sees about 177 billion of the total of 225 being in respect of primary capital. One can see the trend of that over time has been an improving trend over the past 2 years. For the honourable members to get a view of what are the risks that are undertaken by the banks in order to determine how much capital they require, one can see that the majority of the risks are in respect of credit risk, in other words, in respect of loans and advances. So about 75.5% of the exposures for which capital is required is in respect of credit risk, followed then very closely at the top 13.9% by operational risk, and then very small portion for equity risk, market risk and the like. So I think it reflects the fairly vanilla flavour of the asset side of the balance sheets of the banks. Liquidity risk. In terms of the Banks Act, banks are required to hold statutory liquid assets, which are a buffer to be used in terms of in times of need. And on the red bar, one has the calculation of what are the assets or the extent of liquid assets that are required to be held, and that is a percentage of the total liabilities, as expressed as a percentage of the total liabilities, i.e. of the deposits that have been taken in. On the green bar are the actual liquid assets that are held, and one can see that over the last sort of 9 to 12 months, banks have consistently been increasing their liquid asset holdings, and this is generally in line with a more increased focus. Certainly we have also been asking the banks to focus on this, to ensure that they have liquidity buffers. The two areas we've been asking them to look at is firstly on the capital side, that there is increased capital, and secondly in terms of the liquidity buffers that they have, and one can see that they have 75% more additional liquid assets than what is required as at present moment at the end of June. And then also to look at short-term liabilities as a percentage of total liabilities, in other words, those deposits which are maturing in the short term, in other words, less than 30 days, as a percentage of the overall deposits, the higher the percentage, the more risky, the less percentage, the better. And one can see the concerted effort over the last 2 years, where it was 58%, that's down to 53% as at present. So certainly quite a focus by banks on the liquidity risk. Credit risk. Just a few slides on credit risk. The first one is if one looks at the impaired advances to gross loans and advances, and one can see there that the impaired advances as at the end of June, 136 billion rand, compared to 2 years ago where it was 62 billion rand, so just more than doubled over the past 2 years. Reasonably flattened out over the last 3 or 4 months, where it was, if one goes back 12 months ago, there was quite significant growth. That seems to have flattened out now, so it would indicate that the worst of the crunch is over, excuse me, and that we have a ratio of impaired advances to gross loans and advances of 5.9% at the moment, which is up from 2.7% 12 months back. The specific and portfolio credit impairments, in other words, specific provisions and portfolio provisions, one can just see that those have also risen over the period in line with the impairment as the impairment had gone up. And then again, just expressing that as a ratio, if one works through this ratio, the wider apart these two lines are, the better. As they've got closer, that we saw as the bad debts were coming through, these lines got closer, and now we see they're slightly beginning to open up again. So it does show that we are more or less over the worst. So the summary for the figures as at the end of June, As I said, we saw year-on-year asset growth improved during the second quarter, but still remained negative at 0.4%. But if we look at where it came from in December 2009, where it was negative 6.6, the growth in the retail portfolios are still weak and lacking consistency. The profitability ratios do remain slightly compressed, and if you could please just change your slide, it's a slight improvement at the end of the second quarter of 2010. And then we saw the deteriorating cost-to-income ratio, improved capital adequacy and leverage ratios, which are also compliant with international norms. The ratio of impaired advances to gross loans and advances is not improving, 5.9% at the end of June, but whilst it's not improving, it's not getting any worse. So we believe that overall there's low growth, particularly on the retail side, lower profitability levels together with the sticky impaired advances. In general, activity in the banking sector remaining reasonably subdued at the present time. And then lastly, just one slide, just to say that in the annual report, there are appendices 1 to 5 and 7 to 10, which contain administrative information and pertaining to the banking sector, and just highlighted there what all is contained in those various appendices, the names of the banks, the controlling companies, directives that were sent out during the course of the year, and the like. And then Appendix 6 contains extensive quantitative information over a two-year period, which are the numbers behind the graphs and the table which I've just shown, and that is over the 24-month period that one can have a look at how that has progressed on a trend basis for those 24 months. And Chair and Honourable Members, in a nutshell, that is the 2009 annual report in the various chapters with a summary as of June 2010 of the financial situation of the banking sector. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Aaron. This is a very good presentation for the MPC before they make a decision. Before they can make some decisions. We'll pretend that we are in that seat for now. But more on a serious note, I think when I look at the next presentation, it's more about what has happened and what needs to happen moving forward, what needs to be done, or what has happened in terms of the international financial market crisis. This is more the regulatory environment that the South African banking sector has been operating with. The strengths and weaknesses, this first presentation. I think we should combine the two for the sake of time. Take the next presentation in terms of the overall picture of what happened, so that can locate the discussion of your activities and what happened in the market, financial market crisis. After your presentation, we'll take a comfort break and come back for discussions.
If we can just get the second, Chair, if we can just get the second presentation.
Okay, you need some time.
Maybe just 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Honourable members, do you agree with the approach?
Yeah, fine.
Chair, that was a quick 2 minutes.
Yeah. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. To the Honourable Members, a request which had been received was also to give an overview of the international financial market crisis and some views as to the impact of that and the way forward in terms of lessons learned, and also what has South Africa done in terms of addressing the issues which came out of the crisis. So I have tried to give some background as to where this emanated from, to give perspective as to how South Africa fitted in. I should maybe say, as I did allude to earlier during the first presentation, excuse me, that certainly the financial crisis which arose internationally, in the main, the catalyst for that was the banking system, which then really rolled into a number of other areas. Whereas in South Africa, we had just the opposite effect, that the banking system did remain sound and stable during that period and was not a catalyst for any other problems, but certainly the country as a whole was not immune from the effects which occurred from the interconnectivity from other markets. So I think it's quite important at the outset, just for the honourable members to take note of the fact that we did not have a banking crisis in South Africa, unlike our counterparts in a number of the other countries. To start off, it was really the run-up to the so-called subprime market turmoil, which was the forerunner of many other things which then occurred. But within the banking environment, it was the, as I said, the so-called subprime crisis, which then eventually was the catalyst and transformed itself into a full-blown financial market crisis. So if we could just look at what is subprime lending, in essence, loans granted to lower-end or subprime clients who ordinarily would not qualify for loans. This predominantly occurred in the United States, and in essence, higher interest rates are charged for higher risk. But what was occurring with the subprime loans, that in the initial stages, very often so-called teaser rates were given to clients, with those rates which were abnormally low, but would reset after 2 or 3 years. And in extreme cases, loans referred to as ninja loans, no income, jobs or assets, people who had no income, jobs or assets, were recorded loans. But it was with these teaser rates and in the expectation that the property market would continue to rise all the time, and as the property values would increase, so people could access equity in those bonds and keep on paying back in terms of the cycle.
You thought then it was will not help with ninja loans.
I beg your pardon, Chief.
I'm sure the unemployed will not have access to the ninja loans.
So that's just the definition and characteristics of subprime lending. The global economic environment prior to the subprime turmoil, where there was strong economic growth, low interest rates, high levels of liquidity, which then led to investors looking for yield. One found that there were a number of asset managers who were acting on behalf of investors who, because of low interest rates, were looking for yield. Financial markets were very buoyant. Asset prices kept on increasing, which obviously led to an environment of euphoria where credit granting standards were substantially relaxed during that period. So that was really the background to it. And then the US housing market itself, the way it operated was, in earlier years, it was on fixed rate mortgages, so one would get a mortgage loan for 20 years but at a fixed rate. But in the 1980s, as these conditions became prevalent, was the introduction of the so-called ARMs, the adjustable rate mortgages, which resulted in rapid growth. And within those adjustable rate mortgages, one found the manifestation of the teaser rates, which would then be resetting after 2 or 3 years. The subprime mortgages in 2001 was only about 5% of the market, but we saw that grew substantially. And then by February, it was called the 228. So lending was based on the borrower's ability to pay the first 2 years but not really worry about the remaining 28 years in terms of a 30-year loan. As long as they could make the first 2 years, and then if circumstances change and they'd reset and access additional equity in the home as the prices had gone up, they would worry about that at that time. So it was really postponing or putting off the inevitable. So what went wrong? In essence, what went wrong was housing markets began to cool and the housing prices began to decrease. and there were price declines which hadn't been seen since the 1940s, which started to come through. And the subprime lending was based on the basic fundamental that there would always be an increase in housing prices. Teaser rates that were then beginning to reset after 2-3 years were resetting, but obviously customers were unable to meet the higher payment obligations because obviously the equity was not going up. Therefore, they could not refinance the loans, and therein lay the problem that they started to get negative equity in their homes, so they owed more than what their houses were worth. And as this became very prevalent, obviously they could not repay, and there was a rapid increase in the non-performing subprime mortgage loans. If it was only that, I think it would have been fine. Well, not fine, but it wouldn't have been as bad, but what complicated it? What really complicated matters was that, high levels of liquidity and low interest rates, as I mentioned earlier, resulted in low yielding investments globally. And one had investors, pension funds, asset managers, etc., who were looking for better yielding assets. And the subprime mortgage market appeared to be one of those markets in the US which appeared attractive. So on the one hand, you had investors, pension funds, asset managers and the like who were looking for better yield, and on the other hand, one had securitization and let's call them bankers which were responding to these investor requirements, which then embarked on the originate to distribute model. And what that really means is that banks were granting these subprime loans with no intention of actually keeping those loans on their balance sheets. And therein lay the problem. They knew it was high risk, but they had what was called the asset securitization, where they would remove these assets off of their balance sheet and investors would invest in those assets, and thereby the risk would be off of the bank's balance sheet. And that was where collateralized debt obligations came in. So people, or these investors, were taking up asset securitization paper. These vehicles were issuing debt obligations in return for investments, which really exploded during the 2001-2007 period. And the return on these securities in the good times masked the actual problem. And the paper that was being issued was being rated as high quality paper by the rating agencies. So it was really this originate-to-distribute actual model where banks were granting loans with not really having much intention of actually keeping those loans on their balance sheets. The linkage between subprime mortgages, securitization and collateralized debt obligations is really just, I wanted to try and set out for the honourable members a step-by-step part here where firstly the loan is originated, but then it gets securitized. In other words, it gets sold off of the balance sheet. And the securities which back that selling off in the vehicle has paper which it issues, which is graded. And the first tranche that was issued, AAA, AA, so those are the types of assets which would be in that pool for which paper was issued. And one could see essentially it was fairly good quality in terms of the ratings, AAA and BBB, with a very small portion being less than BBB, so about 87% of it being high quality paper. But then what happened is that these assets which had been taken off of the balance sheet and put into various vehicles were in turn re-securitized. So one had a further tranche of these actual mortgages, which were then again repackaged and sold off to the so-called SIVs, the structured investment vehicles. And they would be then graded AAAs. But what one would find is that in those particular areas, those items which were graded as BBB would end up in the re-securitized package as being AAA, because it was the best of that package again, even though originally they were fairly low quality type of assets. And obviously the yields on these were quite high. How was all of this funded? This was really funded over a five-year basis, collateralized debt obligations, where the SIV, the Special Investment Vehicle, would have a billion rands worth of assets that only have equity of 100 million, and 900 million is, in effect, funds which they would have borrowed. Having borrowed those funds meant that they had people who they needed to firstly repay that funding to every 90 days, because it was 90-day funding, and they obviously had to pay them interest on that funding. 90-day funding, but five-year terms in terms of the asset. So a huge mismatch which was taking place there. So it was, as we say, a long-dated paper funded by 90-day investments, which caused a huge liquidity risk on rollovers. Whilst everything was fine, rollovers were taking place. Every 90 days, the funding would be renewed. However, as the subprime loans originally started to default, the market lost confidence in the ratings that were assigned, and those ratings of the AAA and A's, etc. And therefore, the refinancing of these loans, that 900 million, that is what then started to dry up. So the 90-day funding then reverted to overnight funding. And eventually that started drying up. And when that started to dry up, banks had to take these assets back onto their balance sheets. So those assets which they had moved off of their balance sheets originally, thinking that it had gone forever and the risk was gone, suddenly the vehicles who were funding that had no more funding, because the original loans were no longer being financed, because the teaser rates had expired, the rates had reset, and the clients could not afford to pay back. And the knock-on effect right through the system down to the re-securitized asset was that people could not afford to refinance and withdrew their money. So banks then had to start taking this back on their balance sheet and lending to each other, which meant that there wasn't enough to go around, and the interbank lending dried up. And that is the point where banks had to then obtain liquidity from central banks to enable them to meet their liquidity obligations. And in the end effect of that, obviously, was that the original loan criteria or the lending criteria then ended up being far stricter, which meant less loans were made. And again, the circle effect of a recession then setting in, because there was no activity taking place there. So in essence, that was the background to it. In South Africa, what did we do? As I'd mentioned earlier, no direct impact from the first round effects of the international crisis. A number of factors which led to that. The banking sector is not overly exposed to high-risk securitization schemes. There was proper monetary policy, which was well implemented in South Africa, unlike we saw in a number of other countries where the rates were maybe kept too low for too long. And then we'd like to believe that there was a conservative regulatory framework and supervision in South Africa, as well as the contribution from exchange control or exchange controls in South Africa. As we've mentioned, however, for the honourable members, the secondary effects of the turmoil did impact the South African economy as a whole. For example, the global economic slowdown impacting demand, production, exports, and I think we're all quite aware of those issues. And then, obviously, exacerbated by cyclical factors prevalent in our domestic economies, inflationary pressures, bad debt impairments, etc. So what had we done? As I said, in South Africa, In 2005, 2006, we issued a warning to banks. We went around to every board of every bank in South Africa and really just highlighted to them, as we saw it, the so-called banking cycle, where one can see how a banking cycle really works. After a banking crisis, regulators take action, banks become more prudent, and then slowly economy and stock markets start taking off, loan growth starts to skyrocket, new competitors enter the market, there's excess liquidity, the economy starts overheating, and then again one gets the crisis. We went around to all the boards of banks 2006, highlighting to them that we felt we were in the category of 7 and 8. That's where we saw the global banking sector space, and we encouraged our banks to start applying some additional prudence in their activities so as to ensure that when this cycle does complete itself, that our banks were not overly exposed and that they could not end up being in a position where they wouldn't be able to fund their maturing liabilities. So quite a in-depth discussion with each of the boards, which I might add was a very difficult discussion, because when the party is on and there's high levels of exuberance, people don't like to see things like this, but nevertheless that was our job and that's what we did do. Furthermore, in 2007 we engaged with our banks to find out if they had any direct or indirect exposure to the subprime markets, what type of investments had they made in any of those SIVs that I detailed earlier, a list of the securitization schemes, how those have been funded and recent reviews, what recent reviews had taken place of those schemes. We had a full review of off-balance sheet activities of banks, because clearly it was the off-balance sheet items which were growing and growing in the international concept, so we wanted to make sure that we knew exactly what was off-balance sheet. We needed details of any third-party support which they were providing to conduits, the so-called SIVs as I mentioned earlier, and whether, if they were, whether this was included in their ALCO processes, the Asset and Liability Committee processes, whether it was incorporated into their stress testing and into their liquidity calculations. And if they were participating in any geared or leveraged portfolios and any reliance that they had on foreign funding, the extent of that, and if they were experiencing any changes in rollovers, pricing, etc. Banks had no direct exposure to the subprime mortgage market. Their securitization schemes were the traditional cashback schemes, so it wasn't this re-securitization, CDOs and on-lending. Proper liquidity and capital management processes and purposes had been implemented. And where they were acting as any liquidity providers to these schemes, the contingent liabilities, in other words, the off-balance sheet liabilities, were included in their ALCO processes. They had experienced no behavioural change re any foreign funding lines that they'd had. So in essence, there were no alarm bells which were raised with us at that stage. Notwithstanding that, we, during 2008, had ongoing regular communications on a monthly basis with the CEOs of all the banks, chairs of the board risk committees, and chairs of audit committees to ensure that we were fully up to date with any developments that might be taking place, that they might be exposed to, and then requesting them to continuously review their positions and report back on a monthly basis in addition to the normal reporting which they would be doing in terms of their risk profiles and risk positions in terms of the Banks Act. And no adverse reports were received from the banks. We also wanted to make sure that we didn't just believe what they told us, but we then commissioned a review of all the securitization schemes of banks in South Africa, and the initial findings of that there was nothing untoward in any of those schemes, and it underpinned what we had seen in our first glance review of those schemes. And then subsequent to December 2008, which was obviously the landmark date of the Lehman's collapse, we continued to monitor what was going on domestically and internationally. Ongoing interaction with the board of directors, prudential meetings with senior management, focused on-site reviews, thematic reviews, etc., and I did touch on those reviews during the course of the report which I had highlighted in the first presentation. We went through quite a long period of creating the right culture within the organizations, and we actually started this as far back as 1999-2000, where having focused interaction with boards and board subcommittees to ensure that their key roles and responsibilities are recognized and permeated throughout the organization. And I would like to just touch on the topics which we have covered with each bank over these past years, which we term a flavor of the year topic, where boards and board subcommittees need to engage with us on a very focused key risk and key risk issues. During 1999, Y2K, but more importantly, quantitative and qualitative risk assessment in respect to foreign exchange trading activities. In 2000, how does the audit committee function and its role vis-a-vis the compliance function, as well as the role of collateral in credit risk management? Very often one finds that banks have not perfected their security, and when impairments arise and they want to exercise their right to the collateral, one finds the collateral is not perfected and in fact the loan has not been secured. So we looked at the role of collateral in credit risk management. In 2001, the management of risk inherent in derivative activities, as well as the role of the compliance function in relation to that. 2002, the overview of global coordinated group risk management, something which I think showed up in the crisis that was not taking place in a number of banks, as well as the entrenchment of uniform risk management processes, as well as the effectiveness of the operational risk management in the treasury environment and the overview of the corporate governance processes within the organization. In 2003, early on...
Yeah. Now, I think we can go through this year by year, interventions and your focus. What I'm saying is don't have to go
right
point by point again.
Thank you, Chair. One can see that all the key risk areas going through right through up until 2009, and if we go through to 2010 even, 2005 anti-money laundering, audit committee draft King reports, sound liquidity risk management, and then looking at what we're doing in 2010, I think the main message, Chair, and for the honourable members, is just to highlight that over a long period of time, we have consistently been entrenching this culture within the overall management structures within the banking sector to ensure that they are very focused on these issues, and also ensuring then obviously that what the management of banks are doing in the conduct of their business is being properly overseen by the governance structures within the banks. And we'd like to believe that with this as background, that stood us in good stead when the crisis did hit, that a lot of these things had already been handled by the banks right up front. Our response to the international the supervisory developments somewhat overlaps with what we've already discussed in our previous presentation, but for completeness, I thought it would not be appropriate for the honourable members not to have it as part of this pack. So I've just included it in this pack, but I don't need to go into these because I think I have discussed all of these issues in detail already. The Basel Committee processes, the 17 December announcement of the Basel Committee, what we're doing with that. In terms of capital, I think this I would just like to touch on just to bring the honourable members' attention to this particular slide number 30. Just to say, in terms of capital, we have far stricter and stringent requirements for capital adequacy than those that were applied in our international counterparts. and that stood us in fairly good stead. And then in early 2009, we engaged with each of the banks to ask them to improve their capital levels and the quality of their capital, and I think we saw that in the return on equity, not return on equity, on the Tier 1 capital slides and Tier 2 capital slides and total capital adequacy ratios that had improved. Just to highlight that we do have the provisions in our legislation for the proposal that are coming out of the Basel Committee for any capital add-ons that we might wish to do. There will be additional requirements which will need to be implemented. We have a leverage ratio that was introduced as part of our revised supervisory review back in 2008. The 15 to 20 times versus 30 to 60 times in the international environment, which we did talk about earlier. This just highlights the stressed liquidity coverage ratio, which is part of the proposal. And we've already performed some liquidity simulation exercises as well as thematic reviews of liquidity. And we were comfortable with what came out of that. In terms of cross-border, we have regular interaction with those regulators and supervisors in those jurisdictions where our banks might be operating or where banks from those jurisdictions are operating in South Africa. And we are represented on the Basel Committee and in South Africa represented on the G20 and the Financial Stability Board. Forward-looking provisions is already part of Basel II, so that that should be something which should be fairly easy to implement. As I had alluded to earlier, compensation practices had been thoroughly reviewed, and banks at the moment, we are asking them to complete a self-assessment of compensation guidance issued by the Financial Stability Board, which we will be following up with an audit of their responses to that. Anticipated amendments to the legislative framework, this would be the key issues which have emanated from what I've just said, in terms of the macroprudential framework. Those are the areas which would need to be looked at in terms of trading book, securitization. A lot of those issues are already incorporated, and the liquidity framework is the one that we would need to introduce. The Pillar 1 capital requirements we have, the supervisory review process, increased governance standards, and enhancing market discipline being transparency and disclosure, which is there. We are already working with the industry in terms of getting their inputs into the proposals, and we issued draft one. We've already got their comments back on that. We are working on draft two at the moment in terms of those particular areas which we have highlighted there. Future drafts will be issued for consultation with the sector and wider interested parties, incorporating issues from the Basel Committee, etc. And then that will then flow through into the final proposal. So in conclusion, to say that we will be implementing one comprehensive set of proposed amended regulations in January 2012 that will incorporate these various packages which we have discussed, and certain of the work streams which will also carry on still during 2012 will then look for the date of implementation to be the 1st of January 2013. I think very importantly from all the international bodies is that the internationally agreed precondition for implementation is that any of these proposals should not impede the recovery of the real economy and further hamper any of the recovery which one would like to see. Chair and honourable members, that's a whistle-stop tour of the financial crisis, what we had done before the crisis, what stood us in good stead, and then the proposed amendments that we will be adopting in line with international practice as it's applicable to our South African scenario going forward. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Errol.
Like I said earlier on, after this presentation, we'll have a 5 minutes leg stretch, come back here and interact with both the presentations. Honorable members, you're free to walk around, including you, Errol. You're the one who has been doing a lot of work here.